I'm Hillary.
And I'm Sandra. Coming up on the podcast, we're going to talk to clinical sexologist and relationship coach, Dr. Claudia Six.
We are talking about erotic integrity. What is it? We'll find out.
The Quick and the Dirty Podcast with Hillary Welch and Sandra Plagakis.
Sandra, I have a question for you. How did Tim pick out your wedding ring?
My wedding ring?
Yeah, like your engagement ring, sorry.
I don't have an engagement ring, Hillary.
What?
Wow.
What?
I don't have an engagement ring. We eloped.
Okay, so you just like decided, let's go freaking do
this?
Let's
go whatever, we're going to go ever. And then we went to the jeweler and we picked out two cheap rings that we could afford at the time. Yeah, I'm not the right person to be asking.
Okay.
Okay, what's the question?
Is it okay to tell your partner what engagement ring you want?
Have you both agreed that marriage is imminent?
I have said that it's important to me and he has acknowledged that it's important to me.
So you don't know for a fact that marriage is on the table?
No, but I feel like we're getting close to, if at some point it's going to happen, it may happen. We've moved in together. We're at that point. We're like really taking the steps. And I don't want to get an ugly ring that I have to lie about liking for the rest of my life.
I don't think there's anything wrong with somebody talking about the style of ring they like only because it costs so much money. And if I'm a guy, I would want to know that the person I was giving that ring to loved it.
Right. It costs a lot of money and relationships should not be built on lies. That's my biggest concern.
That is the biggest thing. So if I was the guy, I would, if I was a good guy or, you know, somebody who was thoughtful, I would probably take a lot of time to find out what the right ring was.
Right. So I am lucky. Chris has incredible taste. Should he ever so feel inspired to ask me to marry him, I know it wouldn't be ugly. But I don't really want a big diamond. I want a colored stone. And so the other day I was on
specific. I want a colored stone with seven little diamonds around it.
And yes, they all represent the years that we were together before we got married.
And right. My God, Hillary. Holy cow. Estrogen is coming off of you right now. Hard. Hard.
Okay, so here is why this whole conversation happened. I was on Instagram, and you know how Instagram totally nails down your targeted ads and it's unreal?
Yeah, all I see are commercials for Spanx on mine, and yours are diamond rings. That's hilarious.
There was like a antique alternative diamond ring ad that showed up on my Instagram, and I was like, oh my God, I was drooling. They're beautiful. They're not too expensive because I don't want him spending a ton of money. Like enough that it's not like, wow, you chintzed out, but not so much that it's like we're going to be paying for this until our divorce.
You know what? I'm the same. I'd be like, I want you to sacrifice, but not be in the poorhouse, but still be able to make rent.
Right. And then part of me is like, also, it can be a lab created diamond or stone because I want it to look obscenely large. Like, do they have money? But really, we don't.
So yeah, get the lab created diamond, first of all, because that's ethical. Good.
Right.
We like that.
I don't want to rape the earth.
No,
I don't want to do that.
Okay, get the ethical diamond and get it super big and you'll get more for your money that way too.
Exactly. So I sent him a link to this page and I was like, I don't know if you're ever going to be in the market for jewelry for me, but just in case you are, I like this site a lot. Also, I like colored stones, ..
And?
Is that shameful?
Yeah.
It's shameful?
Yes, a little bit. I'm a little embarrassed for you right now. I mean, it's practical and shameful. You see, like I've always said, intent is a big part of it. You're doing it for a few reasons. Number one, you don't want him to drop money on something that you're going to hate and he's not going to be happy. You know that. I know that about him.
Yes. And I don't want something ugly saddled on my finger where I have to lie about how it no longer fits. Marriages should not be built on lies.
Oh, now you tell me.
Yeah. So when you told Tim it's totally okay, we don't have an engagement ring, your marriage was built on a lie.
Can I be honest with you?
That
is so true. It is so true, because although I never wanted to, we're digging deep on this. And I never wanted to get married. And we said that we would get married once we decided to have children. And then we did a quickie ceremony at City Hall.
Okay.
But years later into the marriage, I thought to myself, he never cared one way or the other. I'm the one who never wanted to get married. And I'm the one who forced the marriage only because my dad would have disowned me. So
right.
I know that had I not forced the marriage because of children, I never would have even had anything from the man. Like he's not one to do anything like that.
Right.
And I know I would have resented that, because Disney fucked me up and made me think that I need jewelry to look at it and have a token of love. And that's wrong.
What would you do if he bought you a ring now?
He actually did buy me a ring multiple times in our life, because he obviously sensed the bitterness in me.
So it's not just about the marriage. Don't worry, Tim.
It's just so many other things.
It's intrinsic bitterness. It's fine.
It's just I was just going to be bitter anyway. He bought me a new wedding ring a few years ago, and he put some diamonds in it. It's small, but it's cute. And he basically gave me an envelope filled with cash at Christmas. And he said,
that is so sexy.
Well, you know what? I didn't mind it, because he said, I don't know what you like. I'm terrified to buy you a ring because you are such a scary bee.
Fair.
Here's some money. Please buy the ring that makes you happy.
But why wouldn't he say, let's go shopping?
Well, we did. He came with me, and he held my purse and stood outside the door.
And sweat as you spent thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Well, not thousands. Like, it was like, it wasn't thousands. It was like a thousand and some, you know, it wasn't too much money. It was enough money for me to say, all right, you sacrificed a little for me. Damn straight.
Yeah. I gave you my body and two children.
That's right. I have a gunt because of you, you piece of shit. But yeah, give me the ring. That's great. No, with love, I accept that. And it was nice. And he buys me Swarovski jewelry. Because he knows I just like to sparkle, and that makes me happy. So yes, the wad of cash. You're right. Maybe not the sexiest thing.
Yeah, if Chris did that to me and was like, "Let's get married. Here's your cash," then you feel obligated to spend it on the wedding and not on the ring.
Can I also say the envelope was like crumpled up a little bit, like it'd been in his pocket for a while or something?
Like he'd second guessed whether he was going to give it to you or
no. Like he kept opening it and taking money out. Nah, that ring just got shittier.
Never.
He wasn't smart. He didn't even seal it. So we're going to tackle one of our favorite subjects on the Quick and the Dirty podcast, and that is sex. We love talking about sex, don't we?
Surprise!
Yes. Today, we're so excited to welcome clinical sexologist and relationship coach. She's also the author of the book, Erotic Integrity. How much do I love the title of that book? How to Be True to Yourself Sexually. Please welcome to the Quick and the Dirty podcast, Dr. Claudia Six.
Hello, ladies. It's lovely to be with you.
I am so excited for this conversation, because when I first heard about your book, I wasn't really sure what erotic integrity was. And then as I kind of got deeper and deeper into your subject work, it really hit home for me. We've all been in that situation where you feel like you're living for somebody else instead of yourself.
Yes. Yeah, the erotic integrity are two words that people don't usually put together. So I realized that in my work with my clients, that was my lens for them. And I often didn't even use those words. But what I was looking at was their erotic integrity. Were they being true to themselves sexually? And did they really know who they were as sexual beings? So I was trying to ascertain their level of erotic integrity and have them get clear about what that was for them and what that looked like. So that's kind of how that came about.
How do you know how to be true to yourself sexually? How do you get to that point where you have a full understanding of who you are as a sexual being? That's not a small question, is it?
Yeah, it takes you need to be aware. It's kind of like, you know, how do you know when you're sick or you're injured? You got to pay attention to your body and like, gee, is there something that doesn't feel right? is this something that hasn't felt right for a while, and do I need to pay attention to it? It's kind of the same emotionally. It's like if something doesn't quite feel right, you may not necessarily know why it doesn't feel right or what would feel right. But if there's a level of like ickiness or anxiety, I mean, I use anxiety as an umbrella term for any kind of emotional discomfort. And sometimes people are anxious because they're not being true to themselves. I found a long time ago that when people are anxious, it's because there's a way that they're not being authentic with themselves and they're not being honest with themselves. So sometimes it takes somebody asking you all the right questions to figure it out. But just kind of tuning in to whether are you blissfully happy? I mean, so often I ask people, you know, with clients, obviously, not, you know, in the coffee shop. I say, you know, how's your sex life? And they say, oh, it's good. And then I say, well, what makes it good? And sometimes they can't answer. It may be just the fact that, you know, the penis goes in the vagina every once in a while makes it good. And that's, you know, they don't really sort of expect a whole lot more than that. So I always ask, what makes it good? And people are often hard-pressed to answer that question, and they have to think about it. And it's different things for different people.
I was going to ask, is it always sort of the same stuff, that connection, or is it different for all people?
Not everybody wants connection with sex. I know that's you'd think that people want connection, but there's actually, we're kind of getting off on a little bit of a tangent here, but there's three different styles of sexual engagement. And one is partner engagement, and it's where you want eye contact and eye gazing, and you know, you whisper sweet nothings and you connect and your heart is open, and it's all about the connection, the emotional connection, regardless of what's happening physically. Another style is trance. There are some people who need to like close their eyes and kind of like just really focus on the sensations. And they kind of go off in another zone and they're kind of in a trance state. And it's not so much about engaging the other person. It's about their inner sensory experience. So there's partner engagement, there's trance. And then the third one is role play. Like some people really need some level of role play in order to really get turned on or get off. And that's, you know, what you can either talk about fantasies or, you know, the teacher and the student or, you know, the dom and the sub, whatever, some kind of role play. And that's what people need for sex to be really engaging. So there's three different styles. So not everybody wants connection.
So do you have to be on the exact same page for it to have to be a rewarding sexual experience? Meaning, what if I like to role play and my partner wants to, you know, pretend I'm somebody else and go into a trance? Do you know what I mean? Can that still work?
Well, it can. It depends on the people. But if you want partner engagement and your partner is into trance and even and your partner is into sort of, you know, shutting out, you know, external contact and just focusing on their inner experience, you're going to be sort of out there by yourself sort of wanting connection. So that's not necessarily a good fit. And I'm stirring up a lot of shit for people who might be listening and thinking, oh, well, that's what the problem is. You know, I'm into partner engagement and my partner's into trance. And you have to talk about it or have somebody facilitate that conversation and find what works. I mean, I often talk to clients about this and they're like, oh, that's what's going on. So you can have somebody who's into role play and somebody who's into trance, and that's going to work.
Dr. Claudia, in your TED Talk, you talk about performance anxiety and also the idea that a lot of people feel like they're putting on a show for the other person. Now, how do you know whether you're putting on that show for the other person because you actually enjoy it, or if you're putting on the show because you're more interested in them having a good time than knowing what you actually need?
I think a lot of people focus on giving their partner a good time. But the thing about performance, I really dislike that word because performing is entertaining an audience. And typically when you're having sex, there isn't an audience and you don't need to entertain. It's more about experiencing pleasure with each other. So performance anxiety comes up, I mean, it comes up in cooking, it comes up in singing, it comes up in sex, you know, it comes up in sports, it comes up in lots of areas. most people, I think, are concerned about providing pleasure for their partner. And if somebody is not very assertive or confident or comfortable with their own sexuality, they're going to focus on providing an experience for the partner to their own detriment sometimes. Or if people don't want to be vulnerable, they focus on giving and they don't allow themselves to receive. So in the short term, they seem like a really great lover, but in the long term, there's an inherent imbalance.
So unless you've got one... You know, that is so funny. As this speaks to me, because in my 20s, I felt that I was such a shitty lay. I was putting on a show all the time for the guys that I dated because I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't know who I was sexually.
Yeah,
so
totally.
But as you get older, you figure it out.
Yes. And especially, you know, women in their 20s, I mean, I don't mean to like pathologize and, you know, say this sort of a blanket statement, but nowadays, maybe not so much, but a lot of women in their 20s don't know themselves. They don't know their body that well. They don't know what turns them on. They know they're supposed to look good. And so they sort of like hand their body over to somebody and say, okay, here, you figure this out. You work with it. And I'm going to sort of like, you know, make sure that I look good. And, you know, frankly, it's kind of hard to look good with your ankles around your ears. I mean, you know, there's just some things about sex that just don't look good.
Don't I know it?
Yep. Yep.
Absolutely. And I used to be so, like, worried about what they were looking at because I know that men are very, you know, they like the visual. I would be, like, freaked out and I think, well, I better put on a show, girl, because this is my only move right now.
Yeah.
Right. So I was just so into putting on that show. The older I got, the less I cared. Now I just starfish and hope for the best. But back in the day, I actually cared about giving them the audiovisual experience.
Now, my question is, if you don't believe in performing, but what if you're somebody who gets off on turning someone else on? Is there not a little bit of a show involved in that?
I think lots of people get off on turning on the other person. I think maybe men in particular, because men are sort of wired to provide. I don't know that there's a show necessarily, but a lot of people don't know how to seduce their partner. You know, they don't ask and they never really, you know, sort of get to having that conversation, and maybe they aren't confident enough to try things, and so they don't know how to seduce their partner. And then, you know, putting on a show is sort of secondary. They're just trying to figure out what works.
So do you deal with, obviously you help couples who need help. You're a sexologist, so obviously you're dealing with couples who've probably been together for a very long time. Where does it go wrong? Is it that maybe they've gotten together so young, they thought, like you said earlier, it's just about putting the P in the V? but as time moves on, they realize that there's so much more to it, and somewhere along the way they don't know who they are sexually, and they become incompatible?
Well, I don't just work with couples. I work with individuals or couples. Whoever's willing to show up is what I say. And I don't just see people who have been together a long time. I see people who have been together a few months and want to set themselves up for success and want to nip any problems in the bud. I see people who have been together a few years and are sort of wondering, okay, well, which way is this relationship going to go? Do we make it better or do we move on? And I see people who have been together, you know, 20, 30 years and their kids are going off to college and they're like, you know, left alone with each other. And they're like, well, we better we better fix up this relationship because, you know, we've been focused on the kids and now there's us. And so, you know, what do we want to create for ourselves? So I see all different kinds of people. And I mean, one common scenario, unfortunately, and again, you know, I mentioned sort of common scenarios. I'm not generalizing to everybody, but if you've got one partner who is less interested in sex and, you know, basically makes a unilateral decision that the other person doesn't get to have sex. It's like, I don't want to play with your genitals, so nobody else gets to play with them. And, you know, too bad. You just don't get to be a sexual person anymore. That is a problem. And that is actually a very, very common scenario. And people choose often the comfort and familiarity of the relationship and having built a life together over, you know, erotic integrity and being true to themselves and like, gee, I really need, you know, sexual expression. And do I do it outside of this relationship with integrity? Do I, you know, do it outside of this relationship and just be unfaithful? Or do I do it in this relationship? Or do I get my partner's blessing to say, look, I really need to be a sexual being and my preference is to do that with you. But if you don't want to participate, I need that in my life and I'm going to go find a lover. I want to grow old with you, but I need a lover. You know, I mean, there's lots of different possibilities, but people often don't want to rock the boat or don't want the discomfort of their partner being upset with them. And so it's kind of a heartbreak situation where, you know, people often will choose comfort and familiarity and, you know, frankly, financial stability because divorce is expensive over, you know, erotic integrity.
Do you think if our partners are crappy lays that generally it's our own fault for not having that integrity? Like we've taught them to be bad lays?
Well, what I tell people is if you are getting a steady diet of mercy fucks, you have trained your partner to give you mercy fucks. It's kind of like if you feed the dog at the table, you are training the dog to keep coming to you at the dinner table and beg for food. So if you don't want a mercy fuck, don't accept a mercy fuck.
Right.
You know, it's like every, you know, mercy fuck.
Well, now I know where I've gone wrong right there. I don't take any fuck I can get. So I'm okay. But how do you teach somebody to not give you a mercy fuck? Asking for a friend. Seriously, if that's all you've ever had in your relationship, and I'm half joking right now, but if that's all you've ever had in your relationship, how do you change the dynamic?
Well, first, ask yourself, like, why are you settling for a mercy fuck? Like, why is that? Why
okay,
is that
can you define mercy fuck? Is it just like a gimme? Like, I need to get laid, so I'll give it to you? Is that what you mean?
That's when you have to beg your husband for sex.
It's sort of a lay back and think of England kind of thing. It's like, you know, one person's laying there like a corpse, and the other one is just sort of a hole is a hole. You know, they're just sort of having their way with them and getting off, but there's no, you know, there's no love. There's no enthusiasm.
Right.
Basically, there's no enthusiasm.
For couples who've been together for a very long time, it's hard to get excited as you know, like you were when you first got together, right? Please tell me I'm right.
Well, show me at the beginning of a relationship, you're fucking like bunnies, and you know, and there's nothing to lose, and you're trying everything. And then you get more emotionally invested and there's more to lose. And then that's when people start playing it safe. They don't deviate from the one or two basic choreographies and they don't do anything that their partner might reject them for or say, oh, you know, why do you want to try that? You know, you're a pervert. And then because it's too vulnerable, there's too much at stake. You can't afford to lose your partner. You can't afford to be rejected. So people play it safe. And things get boring. I mean, that's sort of the death of eroticism.
But
you
I think
have
that
to be willing.
Wow.
I think that can happen at an early stage of a relationship too. Like you're in the dating world, and I didn't meet my long-term partner until later in adulthood. And when I would finally meet someone that I actually liked, I would be so careful because I didn't want to ruin it. And maybe not ask for what I actually need. And then a year down the line, it wasn't the relationship I wanted.
Yeah, it's having those conversations that seem the riskiest to have that has the most potential to enrich eroticism in a relationship. It's having those scary, uncomfortable, awkward conversations and not having them during sex. You have them when you're walking the dog or you have them over dinner or over coffee privately. You don't have them when you're driving down the freeway at 80 miles an hour and you can't make eye contact. It's having those awkward conversations. I call it kind of the State of the Union conversation. Like, honey, is there anything we need to talk about? Or, you know, I have a request. You know, this here, you know, would be even better for me if, you know, we did this. And would you be willing to try that? And it's having the awkward conversations that makes things. I mean, you know, even in a friendship, you know, if you have a bit of a dust up with somebody and you have a conversation, it makes the relationship even better.
That's never happened, eh, Sandra?
Oh my God, please. I've been, like, just full disclosure, Dr. Claudia, I've been with my guy for 26 years. And, you know, I mean, there is nothing he will do in bed that will ever surprise me. You know what I mean? So but every couple has a certain rhythm to their sex life, like you say. They have a certain beginning, a middle, and an end. And probably each of us would be able to write that script with our eyes closed. And we know how it's going to finish. Can you change that dynamic to mix it up? I mean, you both have to have that conversation, obviously. And then, but then to take the next step, that is a leap of faith in many ways.
Just do something different. That's all you have to do. Something different. You know, if he's doing the dishes, just go up and start kissing his neck and undo his belt. And I mean, just turn him around and do something different.
It's funny, though, you talked about people aren't, the more you become emotionally invested with someone, the less you are willing to be vulnerable. You would think it would be the opposite, because once you have that emotional connection, you should feel safe to do those things.
Well, hopefully, but it is more vulnerable. I mean, if somebody you know, you've just been dating for a month says you're a freak, you know, why do you want to, you know, stick your finger up my butt? With somebody, you know, there's not a whole lot to lose. If you've been with somebody, you know, 15, 20, 26 years, then you say, you know, I want to try this. And they're like, oh my God, that is just so weird. Why do you want to do that? It hits a lot harder. It's a lot more, you know, upsetting. And hopefully you have the trust by then and they don't say that. But there's more at stake. People don't want to be vulnerable.
How do you tell your partner you're not satisfied without making them feel like a pile of garbage?
You go to my website and you sign up for my email and you get the handout that says how to ask for what you want in bed. Because every time I do a radio interview or a podcast interview, somebody says, how do I get what I want in bed? So I just put it on the website. And if you, you know, sign up for the email, the mailing list, you get that automatically. There's a way of having that conversation, which is setting everybody up for success, which is not making anybody wrong, which is not starting with a negative, which is eliciting cooperation and openness from your mate, and sort of, you know, sort of walking into, you know, sort of praising him and saying, you know, there's something I'd like to tell you that I need. And then you tell him what it would look like, what it wouldn't look like. And then you got to find the win-win. It's not a tit for tat. What if I do this and you got to do that? It's finding the win-win, making it work. So then you go back and forth. It's like, well, how can we make this work for both of us? And it's not about, you know, compromise gets a bad name. Compromise is sort of, you know, synonymous with sort of giving up. Compromise is like creating the win-win. It's like, okay, well, you know, this would work for me. And maybe if we did this, this would work for me. And this would work for you too. And so there's like,
it sounds like such a diplomatic approach as opposed to, hey, I want to stick my finger up your ass. You good with that?
Yeah.
I like the way you do it better.
Yeah, I have a pretty sort of condensed version. I think there's 8 steps. And I've been, it's like, I give very few handouts to my clients, but that's a handout that I give all the time. And just the other day, you know, a former client from like 15 years ago emailed me and said, hey, I'm talking to my teenage child about how to ask for what they want. And you still have that handout. So I emailed the handout.
It's so funny. So I was just thinking about that because we have 2 young girls and they're not there yet. But I very much believe that teaching a healthy sex life and being okay with what you want is important.
Absolutely. And teach them when they're young, teach them before they care. I mean, teach them, you know, to be assertive and ask for what they need, because if they're comfortable with their body and asking for what they need sexually, it's such a gift. And they're not going to be like all twisted up and gummed up in bed and trying to put on a show and trying to be liked and doing stuff that doesn't really work for them. And if they're girls, you know, getting chronic yeast infections because they're not turned on enough. I mean, teach them young.
You know, it's so funny to have this conversation at this age in my life, because in my late teens when I became sexually active and then in my 20s when I was incredibly sexually active, I never had this conversation with anybody about, you know, being sexually assertive in bed. And I just wish I had that conversation. And you talked earlier about couples who've only been together a few months going to therapy to talk about and to work out any sexual issues on the front end. Oh my God, I love that. That's so amazing.
Yeah, I tell people, don't wait till you're in crisis. Just don't. Just, I mean, it's like you don't wait until the car is broken down by the side of the freeway to, you know, change the oil and, you know, change the spark plugs. You go to the mechanic and you do maintenance. And if your car is making a funny sound, you don't wait for it to die on you. You say, hey, it's making a funny sound. Let's check it out. So it's the same with relationships. Set yourself up for success. I mean, if you're in crisis, you're in crisis, but you don't have to wait that long.
But how invested does somebody have to be in a relationship to get therapy as a couple? Because you don't take a rental to the shop. You hand it back in and get a new one.
you need a certain level of emotional investment. I mean, there's always a possibility you're going to learn something that'll serve you in any relationship. That's the great likelihood of that happening. But yeah, you know, if it's like people call me and they say, well, do I bring my partner? And I say, well, do you plan on keeping this partner? Is this the person you want to be having sex with or not? Because if you plan on keeping the partner, it kind of behooves you to bring him into therapy with you and you can work on this together. If you're not sure you want to keep the partner, then let's just talk about what's going on for you. And then you can decide for yourself what's right. So, yeah, if you're invested in the relationship, do it. If you're not, maybe not.
Maybe. I wish when I was in my, again, late teens or early 20s, somebody would have taken me aside and told me how hard marriage is.
Yeah.
And how hard it is. Not even the sex part. It is, all of it's hard.
Yes.
But the sex part can be hard too if the rest of it isn't working.
Exactly.
It's like so much work, Dr. Claudia. My God.
I know. I agree. I totally agree with you. People should tell us how hard marriage is. And what is it? There's a saying like, sex is only 5% of the relationship, unless the relationship isn't going well, and then it's 95% of the relationship or something like that. Like if the relationship isn't going well, sex, is that much more important, and sex doesn't work because sex is a reflection of the rest of the relationship. So if there's a problem in the relationship, there's going to be a problem in the sex generally.
Now, one of the things you cover in both your TED Talk and a couple of the other things that I read and heard from you is the list when you're dating. Because for a lot of people, maybe that first relationship didn't work out, or maybe you never had one and you're just, still out in the dating world. Tell me a little bit more about the list, because I'm not sure I buy into it, I'll be honest.
Okay, that's okay. Not everybody does. So you say the first relationship didn't work out. Maybe it's the first 10 or 15 relationships that didn't work out.
Amen.
So I am a big proponent of the list. If you go shopping for a car, you know whether you want a sunroof, you know how many doors you want, you know whether you want a rear windshield wiper, you know what kind of gas mileage you want. If you're shopping for a house, you know whether you want a yard or how many bedrooms, or if you need a garage or a carport. It's the same with relationships. You kind of need to know what you want in order to find it. You can't just be bumbling around blindly, hoping to stumble into something that's exactly what you want. You're going to stumble into something, and you may find down the line that actually, it doesn't work for you. And again, when you're a young adult, you kind of bumble along, and you're kind of figuring out what's on the list. But I'm a big believer in having a list of yeses, nos, and maybes. It's things that you absolutely have to have. Somebody who has a steady job, a sense mm-hmm. of humor, yada, sort of the basics. Everybody wants to take a walk on the beach and have a glass of wine by the fire. The nos, the things that are absolutely unacceptable. I mean, what if somebody doesn't want children? That's unacceptable. What if they smoke? Is that unacceptable? And then the maybes. Like, what if they're divorced with kids? Is that okay? What if they have a job that takes them out of town a lot? Is that a maybe? Is that workable? So you have to have your list of yeses, nos, and maybes. And the other purpose of the list is that you're committing an intention. Once you write down your list, whether it's in the notes of your phone or on a notepad in your car that you sort of jot stuff down at the traffic light, you're setting an intention. If you don't have a list, I don't think you're setting an intention. There's a way of, like, even if you go on a dating website and you don't meet somebody through that website, you're still sort of setting an intention out into the world to meet somebody. There's a way of sort of putting your money where your mouth is.
So I kind of agree that you need to know kind of what you're looking for. But I also think sometimes we don't know what's good for us. And sometimes if you nail it down too far, you can overlook somebody potentially really amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to, you also have to trust your gut and listen to your intuition.
Like, I know so many, and I will say this, and it's odd. I know a lot of men who have a ton of items on their list, friends of mine, like, think the must-haves for women. And they're just, like, for one person to have all those things, and they don't really bring that much to the table, the expectation is very high to what they are bringing.
Well, that's one thing I help clients with. It's like, I mean, I help clients who are dating or trying to date is having realistic expectations without, you know, shattering their ego, and just being clear about, you know, what they want. I mean, obviously, you know, I think with age we get sort of more aware of what's going to be a fit for us. But I mean, you know, dating the supermodel millionaire is not in the cards for every guy. But I think part of setting yourself up for success is understanding what's going to be a fit. Because I mean, what if you have expectations of your partner because you think that you're going to get borrowed sort of value? Like if this is going to sound bad, but say, for example, you're sort of a regular looking person and you want to date somebody who's like physically spectacular. Does that make you physically spectacular by association? Like, well, I must be good looking because I got a good looking lover on my arm.
Or I must be successful.
That's borrowed functioning. It's like, you know, if you need to be with somebody gorgeous in order to feel gorgeous about yourself, it's kind of a crutch. So on the one hand, it's an unrealistic expectation, but what's underneath that is a certain sort of lack of confidence.
Right. So how do you define those things on your list for what you actually need versus what you would like?
I talk to people about traits. Like, if you're a morning person, do you want to be with somebody who is also a morning person? Or do you want to have your own time in the morning to do your own thing and kind of have your freedom time? And, you know, you'll have to make a more concerted effort to get together, but having a different rhythm actually gives you more freedom. If you're, you know, there are lifestyle things. Like, if you're physically active, do you need to be with somebody who's physically active, or is being with a couch potato going to be acceptable to you?
Or on the opposite, if you're not a very fit person, but you expect a super fit partner, you have to be okay with keeping up.
Or not. Just owning the fact that you're not going to keep up and just appreciating your partner's fitness, if that's okay with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people think they're supposed to have all these like similar affinities. Like we're all supposed to like, you know, pizza and country music and, you know, traveling to Europe. And I mean, you don't have to have all the same taste to enjoy each other. It's about the connection between two people.
I have a friend, Dr. Claudia, and I'm not talking about myself, I swear. I swear to God, she's a millennial. And if she has one gift in life, it's that she has terrible taste in men. She's a troll magnet. And she dates a guy for a few months, and it just doesn't work out for her. And I would say she's a serial monogamer at this point, because she's something of a man eater. And she comes by it honestly only because she has her list. She has the traits that she likes in men. She dates those men, but ultimately, I think her gut leads her down the wrong path. When do you start to learn how to trust your gut? Because I've said to her, what does your gut say about these guys? They check off all these boxes, but then in the end, they turn out to be trolls, little trolls that live under bridges, and they haven't been very nice to her. So, I mean, and I ask her, was your gut telling you they were good guys, or was your gut telling you something different? You have to learn how to listen to your gut. And she's always said to me, my gut was always good on these guys. Because you said earlier, you know, you have to follow your gut to some degree. What if you have a terrible gut? How do you manage that? I want to help this woman.
I have an answer. I think sometimes people confuse intuition with the recognition of an of a familiar dysfunctional pattern.
Ew.
So if you are consistently drawn to men who are tools, as you put it, there's a way that that feels familiar, and there's a way that in your subconscious you are recognizing, oh, this is familiar, this feels right. And all
it's
it
like
is,
I've it's, known it's, you forever.
Right, yeah.
You're just dating the same guy over and over again, that's why, right?
It's familiar in a dysfunctional way, and it's not going to work in the same dysfunctional way. So just because it's tricky to distinguish between intuition, which is just clarity, versus that, I feel like I've known you forever, or chemistry. People talk about chemistry, and I'm like, you know, chemistry is a lot about what you bring to the table. Chemistry is kind of, oh, if you think chemistry is what the other person brings, I think that can get confusing for people. Does that?
My advice to her, and you correct me if I'm wrong. I didn't read into it the way you did, because obviously I have no skill in that department whatsoever. I've been with the same guy forever. What do I know? But I told her, whatever your gut tells you to do, do the opposite. Is that good advice, do you think?
It might not be bad advice for her. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And she's like the type and whatever. So I, you know what? I'm going to tell her that. I'm just going, yes, that's very funny. It's not very funny because I already know in 3 months she's going to be breaking up with the guy she's dating.
My goodness.
Well, friend, I would recommend that she, you know, see a therapist or someone like me who to help her get clear about why she keeps picking guys that don't work out. And you know what? Maybe there's a way that she wants a guy who's not going to work out. Maybe she wants, I mean, I don't know your friend, but maybe she wants sort of the thrill of the novelty, and she doesn't really want to be tied down. And so there's a way that it makes sense to keep picking guys who aren't going to work out.
Maybe. But you know, what she does say is this to me. She says it's a numbers game. Just like how they tell little girls or older women or whatever, you just have to kiss a few frogs before you find your prince. She feels like she's in full frog mode.
Well, maybe she is.
I don't know.
Or maybe she's not being true to her list.
That maybe she's not being true to her list.
Or her list isn't actually what she really wants.
And that's part of the integrity part, right? That you have to know, you have to dig deep and be honest with yourself. I feel like that's the hardest part of the process. Because you may on paper want to be this person, but deep down you're not, right?
Yeah, and in my book, at the end of each chapter, I mean, there's 10 chapters and they all have a different theme. And the idea is that there's something in every chapter that people can relate to. And at the end of each chapter, I have the reader ask themselves some pretty, you know, direct questions. Like, you know, I don't have any, you know, off the top of my head, but questions to help people get clarity and confront themselves about what they're doing and why. And here, let me see. Have you neglected yourself to the point where you don't like yourself and don't want anybody to really see you? Are you withholding sexually because you're angry? Have you let your lover take the blame for your low desire? Have you retreated into masturbation rather than engage your partner because it's easier? So, you know, they're pretty sort of confrontational questions just for the reader to ask themselves.
And, to be honest, at some point in my life, I could have said yes to every one of those.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, that's fine. But it just sort of helps people get clarity. And the feedback I've gotten is people sort of enjoy kind of, you know, in a kind of squirmy kind of way, enjoy these questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me how many, you talked earlier about, you know, relationships that you're not getting what you want sexually from the other person, so that you negotiate stepping outside of your marriage because maybe one person prefers the comfort of the relationship instead of the sexual aspect of the relationship. I feel like more and more I'm hearing about couples who have open marriages. Are you feeling that too?
Open marriage is tricky. And it's one thing to have an intellectual understanding of it, and it's a whole other thing to actually experience it. Because when you experience it, all kinds of feelings come up. You have to be a process queen to do it successfully. You have to be able to have all those uncomfortable conversations. You have to be able to make and keep agreements, no matter what they are. You know, if it's don't ask, don't tell, or if it's share all the gory details as soon as you get home. You know, open relationships are not as easy as people might think.
Is don't ask, don't tell really living with integrity? Or is it just avoiding the inevitable?
No, I think if people are in agreement, like, you know, sure, you know, I don't want to fuck you. Go fuck somebody else and I don't want to hear about it. Just come home for dinner. Then, okay, fine. That's don't ask, don't tell. And they're in agreement. But the thing is, often people sort of like throw that out at the end of an argument. Like, you know, go get yourself a lover. I don't want to hear about it. And then the person acts on it. And then the first person is like, whoa. You know, I was only kidding. It's like, well, you said. So if people are in agreement, and that takes, you know, some honest conversation and self-examination, you know, being really straight with yourself, sure, totally it can work. And then you have the primary relationship at, you know, to sort of to fall back on if things don't work out. But even so, the primary relationship is your ground. There's plenty of people who do that.
Yeah. And, you know, Hillary, that's a good question about integrity and don't ask, don't tell. And I would say this, not everybody is built to hear the gory details. If Tim told me today, and if he went out and had an affair, whatever, we had the don't ask, don't tell, and then, you know, he wanted to tell me about it, I'd be like, I'm good. Like, I don't need to know the details. I know that it happened. We made the agreement. What do I care what you did in the bedroom? I already know your moves. I'm good.
Yeah, but sometimes I wonder if couples say, okay, we're going to do this don't ask, don't tell thing. And then it gets to the point and it's really just that they want to ignore the fact that their partner, like they're not really okay with the fact that you're seeing someone right. else. They just don't want to know.
Yeah.
So they're not actually being, they're not actually having any integrity with themselves saying like, I'm okay, because they're not okay.
Exactly. So they're being out of integrity. It's all tricky stuff. Tricky stuff.
But at the heart of all of this, out of heart of every marriage, at the heart of every good sex life, at the heart of everything, you really have to know who you are first before you can be a great partner to somebody else.
Yes. And that's, you know, the secret of that is that it comes with age. And people complain about age. But, you know, the well-kept secret about age is self-acceptance. It's like the older you are, I mean, hopefully, for most people, the more you like yourself and the more you accept yourself. So it's like, you know, your ass is sliding down the back of your thighs, but you like yourself more.
Yeah, it's too late to change this, so we just got to go with it.
That's right. And there's a level of fearlessness, too, that comes with age. Trust me, I know. I recently had a pretty big birthday, and I realized that I have, Hillary, not a word.
Except.
It's just not a goddamn word from you. And I realized, I took stock in my age and who I am as a person, and I realized I almost have zero fucks to give. And there's so much freedom that comes with it.
Yeah. It's self-acceptance and you know, try telling a 20-year-old that, because, you know, they're not going to believe you necessarily, but it is something that happens. So for all your listeners, it's like, you know, that is something to look forward to.
Dr. Claudia Six, thanks so much for hanging out with us today on the Quick and the Dirty podcast. If somebody wants to find out more about living with erotic integrity, where can they find you and your book and all your materials?
They can find me on my website, which is drsix.net, and it's drsix.net, drsix.net, and there you can get the book, you can do an erotic integrity test and sort of ascertain your own level of erotic integrity. It's totally confidential. I won't know anything about it. There's videos, there's different pages about different topics.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Love talking to you today. I really loved it.
Likewise, ladies.
Thank you so much.
This episode is over, but the conversation doesn't have to be. Follow Hillary and Sandra on social. Instagram at Hillary on Air, at SandraKiss1053. Twitter at Hillary Welch, at SandraKiss1053. And on Facebook at Quick and Dirty Podcast. Got a question? Email Hillary and Sandra, thequickandthedirty@gmail.com.
Don't forget, you can download the podcast each week to your mobile device to listen offline. Find The Quick and the Dirty on frequencypodcastnetwork.com, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcasts.